Hello and welcome to the Retro Odyssey podcast. I'm your host, Steven, here with my co-host, Matt. How's it been, Matt?
Not bad, thanks. Just been enjoying a week off work. How are you?
I have been working almost nonstop because it is tax season in the U.S. and I have two jobs preparing taxes. So I've been very, very busy.
Sounds like a lot of fun.
But you know what? If people want to pay me to do their taxes, I will gladly take that money.
Oh yeah, definitely. Get it where you can.
So what have you been playing since we last spoke?
Well, I want to start off with what I've not been playing, actually. Because after several years, I've actually finally cancelled my subscription for Final Fantasy XIV. I still love the game. Story is fantastic. I'm still going to be playing the expansion and stuff when it comes out. But as I mentioned before, like for the past year and a half, like my daily MMO has been Guild Wars 2. It doesn't have a subscription cost. It doesn't have a gear grind. So Final Fantasy XIV, I no longer bother with the gear grind. And I only log in for story patches. And the only reason I was keeping a sub going is because I have a house in the game. Now, houses are quite hard to come by. They're expensive, like difficult to get. So if you have one, you generally want to hold on to it. They don't really provide any gameplay value, but it's just like a nice house that you can customize and put a load of like furniture in and stuff like that. But it kind of occurred to me, like, I'm paying £10 a month for a virtual house that I barely use because I'm only logging in for the story patches. And if you don't enter your house once every 30 days, then it gets, they call it a demolition timer. They put a demolition timer on, and a few weeks later, the house is demolished and you no longer have it and it gets sold to someone else. And you kind of like, you don't get like the money back that you paid for it. It's just gone. But like I said, I barely used it. And as much as I loved having like my own little house, it's not worth £120 a year for me. You know, so yeah, I just decided to cancel the sub. Like I said, I will be coming back for the expansion. I have a friend who is pretty hardcore with his crafting in the game. So if I do fall behind on like gear, I can just get him to make me a set of gear. You know, he said he's like happy to do that if I fall behind on the gear grind. So I don't need to be going in and doing like trials, dungeons, raids every day. I'll do them all once, but I'm not really interested in farming them every day.
Right. Well, and realistically, you can do your daily roulettes, get a bunch of poetics, and then just get whatever the current poetic gear is and probably be fine. I mean, like, you're not going into like ultimates and no. The super high end content, so you don't really need the best of the best.
No, and I mean, the last time I got a gear upgrade was about a year ago and I was still able to do the last patch perfectly fine.
Yeah,
that came out like in Feb. So I just don't need to be doing that stuff when all I'm doing is the story. So so that is what I'm going to be doing from now on. Just I'll sub when there's a patch, and then I'll cancel it afterwards. And as hard as it was to kind of like let go of the house, that is kind of like a burden taken off. You know, so I'm no longer spending £120 on a house. data use.
Yeah, and that makes perfect sense. I mean, you know, if you're not getting the value out of it, it doesn't make sense to keep paying into it.
So yeah, I've not been playing that for a while. I have been playing, as I mentioned, Guild Wars 2. That has just had a patch as well. Like I said, that game doesn't have a subscription cost. There is, the way they're doing it at the moment is they are putting out like a yearly expansion, which costs like, I believe it's like £25 for standard edition and about £40 for deluxe edition. So all I paid like for the last expansion last summer was like £40. And there's been no other costs like since then. All of the patches throughout the year are free. There's no sub cost. There's no gear grind in the game. So that is, it's kind of spoiled me for other MMOs in a way, because it does all this stuff that really pissed me off in other games. So that's kind of like, it's just made me see like the stuff that I didn't like in other games, essentially. Having said that, I have actually reinstalled World of Warcraft, but I'm not actually paying for a subscription. I wanted to see what I could do with a free trial.
Mm-hmm.
Because you can play up to like level 20, and now they've done like a massive level squish, so you can go into like all the expansions and it'll just scale to your level. And I found out when I like reinstalled it that they'd actually given me the previous expansion, Shadowlands, for free. And I like never played that before. A lot of people hated it. I will probably hate it, but like completely for free, I started a new character. I've started playing through that expansion. And I'll see how far that free trial will let me go.
Right.
Because if I did want to kind of like pay for a subscription, I can also pay for a subscription with in-game gold,
mm-hmm.
of which I have rather a lot in World of Warcraft from the decade or so that I used to play. But I'm going to see how far the free trial takes me at the moment.
One of the things I've always heard about old school RuneScape that was nice is that once you get the sub going and start making a lot of money in game, you can basically have the sub maintain itself.
Yes. EVE Online does the same thing. If you are making a hell of a lot of money in EVE Online, you can pay for your subscription through that. So it's like a nice way to do it, but I'm hoping it will actually let me play through this whole expansion on the free trial. But we'll see.
Mm-hmm.
But that is essentially all I've been playing. Oh, I did technically finish Final Doom. I finished TNT a while ago, and I've been playing through the Plutonium Experiment. Which is a lot better designed than TNT, and I enjoyed it quite a lot. But the last level is absolutely bullshit, so I turned on God mode for it. It just throws so much stuff at you. There's a cyber demon, there's an icon of sin, there are so many ranged enemies around you, and it just really ramps up the difficulty, and it has the same amount of enemies on every difficulty level on that particular level, so you can't even kind of like turn it down to get less enemies. And it was absolutely bullshit. I spent like probably about 20 minutes trying to grind through this level, and it wasn't happening, so I turned on God mode and finished it. So I'm going to call that finished.
Yep.
It's like it's not worth my time to fart about with that. So I will call that finished, even though I didn't technically legitimately finish the last level.
It's not that big a deal.
Mm. But that is more or less everything that I've been playing. I mean, there was a Vampire Survivors update. It was a small update, nothing much to say about it, but I've gone through and gone all my achievements in that. So what have you been playing?
Well, I have been playing a lot of Final Fantasy 14. So I've got my main character, and then I had a couple other ones for different things, and then I actually started another one because I found Wrath Games and his solo challenge. I found that very intriguing.
Is that the guy who had to get a whole bunch of other solo players to do the Alliance raid?
Yes.
Yeah, I did actually watch that video where it was doing the Alliance raid.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I was watching those videos, and before the Crystal Tower video came out, I actually went and watched the live stream where they did it. And I was like, okay, this sounds like a very fun and interesting challenge. So I started a new character for that, and that's been taking a lot of time because the grind to get through some of the early games solo is significantly longer than just doing it normally. But yeah, it's enjoyable, and I actually ended up the character I did for it. I ended up doing an entirely new account and did it on the free trial because the free trial lets you play, you know, Heavensward and Stormblood up to level 70, no limits on playtime, et cetera, et cetera. So I was able to do all of that and play on Xbox so I could take part in the beta
because the
beta was only for new players. It's like, okay, well, I'm doing a thing that, you know, actually benefits from the free trial because the key to the solo thing is no interaction with other players. So no market board, no retainers, no parties, no free companies. Well, that's all stuff you can't do on the free trial.
How do you deal with the MSQ trials?
You massively over level and overstat yourself.
All right.
Because basically the way that we do the dungeons and trials is the goal is to do as many of them level synced as possible, and you can do most of A Realm Reborn solo level synced if you have the right gear and equipment.
And plus with the dungeons, you can go in with AI companions anyway.
Well, they actually don't use any of that either. It's 100% solo.
Wow, so you've really got to out-level stuff.
Yeah. But, for example, at a certain point, the dungeons start level syncing your gear. So, like, you know, there's the one that I'm working on right now, the dungeon syncs your gear to, like, level 34. So, once your gear is above that level, no other gear upgrades are going to help you. So it basically then comes down to your potions and your consumables and then your raw skill in terms of mitigations and handling damage. But it is possible. Like, there's a lot of people that have... there's people that claim to be all the way in Shadowbringers using this rule set. But it's essentially like you attempt to do level synced, and if that's just impossible, you do it with Silence Echo, because the Epic Echo makes a lot of older content trivial when you're by yourself, especially with the way the stats are now after the squish. The only time that they've been using the full echo from an unsynced dungeon is if it's just impossible to do with it under any other circumstances.
Yeah.
But it really is. It's a very different set of skills than you normally need, because you know, you go into these duties normally and you just have to think of your one job. Whereas here you have to think about all three, and you honestly get better at the game.
Oh, I bet, yeah.
And it's funny, it actually is it's more similar to the deep dungeons in terms of skill set, because you know you can't take wall-to-wall pulls when you're by yourself.
I've seen warriors do that.
Yeah,
like, I have seen warriors take on a hell of a lot of enemies solo.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and warrior is the main class that people are using. It's warrior and gunbreaker are the main ones. I think there's a couple of people trying it with different jobs, but the main jobs they use are warrior and gunbreaker. But it's, yeah, there's a whole community in Wrath Games Discord, and they're, you know, continually growing as people find his videos and decide to try it themselves. But yeah, so that's a cool thing that I've been doing.
Have you done any more Endwalker?
I don't remember where I was last time we talked, but
I think you said you just done the first dungeon.
Oh yeah, so I have done more. I got to I got down to the big vault, like, you know, nature preserve thing.
Oh yeah, the Labyrinthos.
Yes. I got down to that and then got kicked out of it. I'm trying to remember what was the last thing I did, cuz I know I got through the thing where you and your team like basically split up and then reconverge. I did all the stuff in Thavnir, and then I did everything with the Charlian group. I can't remember. It's been a little bit, but I did make more progress. I don't know exactly where I am in terms of like percentage, but I have done more of Endwalker, and it's, I mean, I'm enjoying what I've seen so far.
Oh yeah. Yeah. It's really good. The one thing that I like about like Thavnir and Labyrinthos as well is that you do go there earlier on and there's like low level content, but you go back and there's high level content in those zones as well. So it's kind of like, it's good to have like zones where there's kind of like an early section and then a late section later on.
Right.
Cause you'll probably notice you've only explored like half of each zone.
Yeah.
That's good design on that. I like that.
Yeah, that's absolutely, you know, a good way of doing it, because knowing that there's more to be explored, it, you know, it encourages you to press on and come back. And that's ultimately what you want as a game designer, is for people to come back and keep playing. But yeah, so that's what I've been working on with 14. I've kind of been jumping around a lot with some other games. I went back to Stranger of Paradise briefly and played that for like a week, and then just kind of fell off again. I went back to continue working on Final Fantasy 13 from a couple of years ago, got to Pulse, and then have been working through that large grind. I mean, I even started up Lightning Returns for a couple of days just to go back and experience that combat system again. And then the other big one I've been playing is I've been trying to actually finally finish Final Fantasy X-2 instead of just playing the initial, like, you know, 3 hours.
I've only played the first hour of that.
I mean, it's a game I really enjoy. I mean, especially because it's so similar to 13, which I didn't realize at the time, but I discovered that the dev team that made 10 and 10-2 immediately started working on 13. It's like, oh, that's why there's so many similarities between 10 and 13. I enjoy 10-2. I know it gets a lot of flack for being a little different. There's a lot of people that don't like it just because of the aesthetic, or, you know, it's all girls, or it's, you know, all dress up. It's like, you know, the gameplay is still fun, and it's, you know, the story is not as good as 10, but
it's not going to be. I mean, that's
probably
the best story of all the single player Final Fantasies.
Yeah, like it is very difficult to reach that level of story. What I appreciate is it continues the story in a way that still makes sense within the logic of the world, and it doesn't completely ruin the story of Final Fantasy X, which, from what I've heard, some of the supplemental material does.
It's funny you should say it makes sense within the logic of the world, because Wacker getting together with Lulu does not make any logical sense.
And that's
no chemistry whatsoever in the first game.
That one's a little bit of a stretch, but I can, you know, I can deal with that. He did develop over the course of the game, so he's, you know, he's at least better than he was at the start. But yeah, that is admittedly a weak point. But you're not dealing with them for very long. But I didn't feel like the idea of Yuna wanting to go on another adventure was absurd, like some people have said. Especially given, you know, the context of why she goes on the adventure and all of that. But I don't know, it's one of those things that, like, yeah, it's not as good as the previous game, but it wasn't gonna be, so I can just enjoy it for what it is.
Yeah.
And what it is the early version of the Paradigm system from 13, which is one of the best combat systems they've ever done.
I agree, and it's a shame that 13 kind of like hides it behind several hours of gameplay before it really opens up and shows you what that combat system can do.
Yeah. Yeah, and the thing that I always find the most indicative of how open that system can be is I don't think I've talked to any two people that use the same team as their core three for 13. Because, like, I know one person focuses more on debuffs. One person I've talked to does things very balanced. I tend to go for a double synergist and focus on buffing my party. And, like, all of it is viable. Like, there's so much variety.
I think I kind of, like, changed it up, like, constantly throughout the fights. Mm-hmm. I'd get all my buffs out, then I'd try and get the stagger going, and then I'd switch immediately to like full damage, and yeah, I would keep switching it throughout.
The sheer variety of what you can do with that system, that in itself is proof that it was a good idea, and I do think they did a good job expanding it in 13-2. It's not the same in Lightning Returns, but it's still enjoyable. But yeah, that's basically it. I've been playing just a lot of Final Fantasy. It's just, aside from 14, I've been hopping around with a whole bunch of different games.
Yeah, cool. Well, if that's everything that we've played, we do have one news story this month. We don't tend to go too much into news stories because they've generally been talked to death by the time we get to them. But we did want to make mention of the passing of Akira Toriyama, who was the inventor of Dragon Ball, hugely, hugely successful manga, which turned into an even more successful anime. But he also did character design for Chrono Trigger, which is like one of the best RPGs ever made. And he also did character design for all of the Dragon Quest games as well. He is like a hugely, hugely influential guy in a lot of different fields.
Yeah, I mean, and I saw a post about it, basically talking about how Akira Toriyama is a large driving force of why anime took off in the West. I mean, that might be a little bit of an exaggeration, but it's not that much of an exaggeration. Because Dragon Ball was a big part of getting a lot of people in the U.S. into anime.
I believe the manga came out in the 80s, didn't it? Well, it started to come out in the 80s. I'm not entirely sure when the anime came out. But around about the 80s is where anime really kind of like started to take off in the West with stuff like Akira and Ninja Scroll, Ghost in the Machine, stuff like that. So, yeah, I can see with the success of that manga, I can see that kind of would have been a driving force.
Yeah, so I don't know the exact numbers. I know America got Dragon Ball Z in 1996. And by the time America got it, they were already on like the third or fourth arc in the Japanese version of the anime, which again is, you know, way after the manga. Like, I think the manga might have already been, no, the manga wasn't finished by then, but it was pretty far along. But yeah, like there's a lot of people that were introduced to, so there's the old diehards that I actually know a few who would, like, you know, go to the video store and get like tapes that some guy had subtitled himself. Like, the process for getting anime in the late 80s, early 90s was a lot more difficult in the US. But one of the big things that helped anime take off, and especially, you know, animes like Dragon Ball, was Toonami on Cartoon Network, which showed a ton of Dragon Ball Z in the early 2000s, and there's a lot of people, myself included, that discovered anime through those time blocks.
Yeah, I've just had a look, and the Dragon Ball anime, or the original Dragon Ball anime, was 86 to 89, and then Dragon Ball Z was 89 to 96.
Okay, yeah, so Dragon Ball Z in Japan was finishing when the US got it to begin with.
Yeah, and the manga ran from 84 to 95.
Mm-hmm. And like you said, you know, his work is far beyond just Dragon Ball. I think he did a whole bunch of other anime as well.
He does have one called Crusher Joe, Kazuki and Rikimaru, the Dragon of Kompei Island. Most of his work has been in manga. There is like quite a long list here. I don't actually recognize any of the names. I'm not a manga guy. Obviously, Dragon Ball is the biggest one. He's done a lot of stuff. Like I said, not just manga, anime, but video games. Every single Dragon Quest game he's done character designs for.
Yeah.
Chrono Trigger, Tobal. Obviously, the Dragon Ball video games as well. Hell of a lot.
He definitely has a wide impact. I think there's another vigil happening in Final Fantasy XIV for him. Not as big as the one for the creator of Berserk, but there are some people standing in Ulda with the flames out. Because, I mean, he had a big impact on a lot of culture.
Yeah, I remember the ones for the creator of Berserk. They had a huge line of Dark Knights. Just, I believe the Dark Knight gear is a little bit similar to kind of like the main character of Berserk. Again, I'm not an anime guy, but they were rows and rows of like Dark Knights.
Yeah, so there's that happening, not to that extent, but there's a bunch of people out in Olda, a lot of people in gear that looks like Goku's outfit from Dragon Ball Z. He had a massive impact, and he's a creator I've always appreciated. Number one, because of the quality of his art. But number two, because when he saw the Dragon Ball movie, he was so angry that he went back and made more Dragon Ball so that wouldn't be the last thing. And you know what? I can respect that. He had a big impact on many different areas of culture. And I will say, a life well lived, but it is sad to hear of his passing.
Yes, definitely. It was 68, according to this. We just wanted to kind of like bring that up because, like I say, even though he is more well known for Dragon Ball, like I said, he has done stuff that we've covered. So we just wanted to bring that up. Thought it was important just to have like that little section just to remember one of the big guys in the industry.
Yeah, and I mean, he, like I mentioned, he had a big impact on me personally in terms of discovering anime and the, that entire genre of media. Just because, like, Dragon Ball Z was the first anime that I actually watched. He's always been kind of a big deal to me. And then, like we mentioned, Chrono Trigger is one of my favorite games, and that art has his hallmarks all over it, and it's all fantastic. So yeah, we felt that it was important to mention.
Yeah.
So with that out of the way, I think we're gonna take a quick break and move on to our main topic for the day. All right, so our topic for this episode is actually, I'm not sure what to call them. So the reason we picked this is because it is the 30th anniversary of the Daytona USA arcade game. If you were in arcades in the 90s and even the early 2000s, you remember Daytona because it was one of the most common big racing arcade games that would have the whole setup with the wheel and like usually at least two stations, usually four.
Some of the better arcades had eight.
Oh yeah, that's true. Yeah, this was massively huge to the point where, like, if you go look at if you just look up Daytona USA arcade, it'll come back and say which one, because there's a bunch of different versions of the arcade game, and it was ported to home consoles a few times. So we decided to talk about that. What was the actual date for the anniversary?
March 1994 is as accurate as it gets.
Okay.
At least on the Wikipedia page, Japan and North America, March 1994, and then worldwide, April 1994.
Yeah, well, and it's much harder to have a solid release date for arcades than it is for home console stuff. as someone who frequented arcades a lot in the late 90s, early 2000s, I played this game a lot. It was always fun to get into the racing arcade games and, you know, have all the fun with that. What are your experiences?
Well, I never actually played this in the arcade. I think I gravitated more towards the fighting games in the arcade, and I really like the light gun shooters as well. I was never hugely into the racing games, at least in the arcade, outside of Hang On. And I loved Hang On because it had like a full size bike. Well, it wasn't full size, but it was a pretty big bike that you actually sat on and mm-hmm. controlled the game with. But outside of that, it was mostly the fighting game, so I didn't really have an experience of it in the arcade. I do remember having this on PC. I believe it was one of the first PC games I got. I have very, very little memory of actually playing it on PC, but I know that I had it, and I know that I did play it. I don't think I played like a hell of a lot of it. Of course, I know about the cultural impact of it because it's mentioned and brought up like quite a lot. And until this podcast, I had never played the Saturn version, which it was a launch game for the Sega Saturn, and I couldn't find a working arcade ROM, so I played the Saturn version for this. And this was the first time that I've actually put like significant amount of time into it, so I don't really have that much of a history with it.
But, I mean, that's if you weren't really playing the racing games in the arcades, then that makes sense. I tended to jump around and do a little bit of everything in the arcade, but yeah, that it is a good one. Obviously, you know, even if we were emulating the arcade version itself, we can't really duplicate that experience. But it, you know, it's a fun game. It's obviously, you know, from the early 90s, it's not gonna be as refined as some of the more modern racing games, but for the time, it was actually pretty well done.
You say like kind of like more refined. I kind of like feel the early arcade style of racing game control, I actually find it more palatable than a lot of the later ones, which kind of, as technology caught up, a lot of races got a lot more realistic in the way the cars handled. I really, really like the simplicity of these early races that just handle in a completely different way to most races do now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that arcadey style was definitely a thing. I think I want to say the last one that had a similar feel to this one was probably the Crazy Taxi arcade game, which is, you know, like a whole different can of worms, but it was kind of that more simplified version of racing game controls. But yeah, I can see that. I mean, regardless, it's a good game. It, you know, I was very, very bad at it, both back then and now, but it's a good game.
Oh, yeah, me too. I do have, like, some bugbears as well. There's not kind of, like, a mode where you can continue playing after a race. It's like, you go into a race, once that race is done, whether you come first or you come last, that's game over, that's your credit done. I kind of feel like if you're playing this in the arcade, that you kind of wouldn't feel as though you had value for your money, because you will only play one race regardless of whether you win or lose.
Yeah.
Whereas I really would have preferred it if you do come in like first, second, third place or something, it lets you do the next one. Until you've done all the courses, of which there are only three, by the way. for an arcade experience, I would expect if I win to be able to continue playing, and right. and this doesn't do that.
Ah, that's fair. You tend to forget that that's how a lot of the racing games worked back then. I think there might have been like one or two that would let you continue if you won, but I think a lot of the racing games were like that, where you did one race and that was it.
And I also kind of feel, you know, with the fact that there were only three courses, it kind of isn't a really good value proposition for a console version.
Mm-hmm.
Like if I had paid full price for this on Sega Saturn back in the day, I would have been disappointed. I mean, the Saturn version does have an additional mode, which turns off the timer if you want, but you are still playing on those three courses, and that is not a lot for a racing game that you've kind of like paid like 40, 50 quid for.
Right.
So I kind of feel like whilst it is a very good game, there's not a lot of content to justify a full price.
Mm. Yeah, that's fair.
I wasn't able to experience the arcade version. The Saturn version handles decently in terms of like the car physics and stuff like that. The frame rate isn't great on the Saturn version, I have to say. I think it's dipping like below 30, definitely, in Saturn, which is fair enough. Saturn isn't known for being kind of like 3D powerhouse, but it is still perfectly playable. But having seen arcade footage that looks butter smooth, I was kind of a bit disappointed that I wasn't able to find a working arcade ROM.
I think the Dreamcast version ran a little bit better. But yeah, it definitely does not compare to the way it ran in the arcade, because I mean, that's, you know, the hardware it was designed for. And like you said, the Saturn wasn't exactly known for running well.
So how does the Dreamcast version actually play them?
I mean, the Dreamcast version was fine. I mean, obviously the stick's not going to feel as responsive as the wheel, but it was all right. I mean, I was, you know, like I said, just as bad that now as I am as I was then. But you know, it played all right. I didn't notice a lot of stuttering or anything, and I think the audio was fine as well. So yeah, the Dreamcast version definitely was technically sound, but it did suffer from the same things you mentioned, the, you know, lack of tracks and only a couple of game modes.
Yeah, but I might see if I can pick up a cheap Dreamcast copy though, because I would like a version of this game that is kind of like closer to the arcade.
Mm-hmm.
Because annoyingly, there does seem to have been a press release a couple years ago. This might not be legit, but they were going to release Sega Ages Anthology Volume 6 Daytona USA for Switch, Xbox One, and PS4, which would include all of the Daytona games, but apparently they lost the license before they were able to do it. Like I said, I don't know if that is a confirmed press release. There are... I found one source for it on one site.
Mm-hmm.
And a few other pages referencing that one source. So I don't know how legit that is, but I absolutely would have picked this up like for modern consoles. It was available briefly for PlayStation 3 and Xbox 360. It's not anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So I absolutely would have picked that up on modern consoles. And I would have played the crap out of that. Because there isn't a good, legit way to play this at the moment.
Yeah.
You're going to have to pick up a physical copy for either Saturn or Dreamcast, or indeed PC. Probably won't run in Windows 10 or 11. or you're downloading a ROM.
Yeah.
Which is a shame, because I would pay for a collection with all the Daytona games in. Absolutely. Probably the best way to play this, actually, it's featured in Like a Dragon, Gaiden, The Man Who Erased His Name. It is playable in an arcade in that game. It's just called Sega Racing Classic 2 because of licensing issues, because right. obviously, like I said, they lost the license. But it is available. If you have Like a Dragon Gaiden, that might be the best, honestly, the best way to play this game. Before we finish up on this game as well, I want to mention the soundtrack, which is weird, but really good. The guy like sings the title, and when you start the race, like the thing is with Daytona, you don't kind of like start on a racing line to a timer. You actually do a rolling start, and the guy in the music track sings rolling start. It's like rolling start. He sings it better than that, but it's kind of like really, really upbeat music. And when you get a game over, he kind of like wraps the letters to game over, like G-A-M-E. It is odd, but yeah, and it's a really, really good soundtrack. And yeah, it is available to buy as well, the soundtrack on CD. And that
is one thing you probably can't appreciate as well in the arcade.
Unless you are kind of like right next to an arcade machine, generally they're going to have the audio turned down quite low.
Yeah, or the surrounding noise will be a lot, will be enough that you can't really hear it. Yeah. I don't remember ever noticing that before, but it's entirely possible. It's just because you can't hear much in the arcades. That is kind of amusing.
And also the arcade version does have kind of like a voice in your ear telling you, like, you know, like a co-driver thing they kind of like have in some stock car races. Mm-hmm. They do have someone saying stuff to you in the arcade version, which the Saturn version didn't have. In the arcade playthrough that I watched, the music was a little bit too high, so I couldn't really work out what they were saying. But there is someone saying something.
That does sound familiar, but I mean it's been so long. My memories of it aren't rock solid.
I do hope that Sega get back on the arcade racing game train again, because they have made some really, really good arcade games, like OutRun, Virtual Racer, this. They have done like some really, really solid, like really well remembered games. And despite what I would call a lack of content in this particular one, it is still really fun to play.
Yeah, I mean there's a reason that it came out in 94 and I still was playing it in the late 90s, early 2000s. Sega did very, very well in the arcade space. I feel like outside of a couple of notable exceptions, Sega probably did better than Nintendo in the arcades. It's just that Nintendo kicked all kinds of butt in the home console market.
Yeah.
But I mean, I think even today, you know, I mean, obviously we don't have arcades like we used to in the US, but I know Japan still has some dedicated arcades, and I think Sega still makes a lot of those arcade cabinets.
Yeah, I mean, I've not been in an arcade for ages, so I don't really know what's new in the arcades. But yeah, like you said, absolutely, definitely nothing like they used to be.
Yeah. Well, I mean, does the traditional standalone arcades are really only in Japan now? So I think that's all we have for Daytona USA. So we'll take a quick break and come back with our other game for the day.
Okay.
We'll be right back.
So our second game for the day is a... It was considered to be a rival to Daytona USA. It's Ridge Racer, originally coming out in 1993 in the arcades. 93 in Japan and North America, and then 94 in Europe. You know, full disclosure, I had never heard of this game before, and even now, still have not played it because I did not find a working version.
Well, I also struggled to find a working version. I did manage to get one working, but the sound was all jacked up, so I had to turn the sound down and essentially play it silent. But yeah, I guess it's a difficult one to emulate.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, this kind of like spurred Sega to make Daytona as kind of like a rival to this, and they did battle it out in the arcades for quite a while. Like these were the two main racing games at that kind of like time in like 94, mid-90s. And I believe Daytona was always the more popular of the two. Rightfully so, because it's the better game. But like... Daytona, this also ended up on home console as well. This was actually a launch title for the PlayStation 1. Like Daytona USA was a launch title for the Saturn, and helped to sell that. This helped to sell the PlayStation. And it's a very similar kind of game. It's another like stock car racer. It's meant to be kind of like based on what's that American car thing that you guys have? NASCAR. Yeah. NASCAR is like, it's like not a thing in the UK whatsoever. But I know it's like really, really popular in the US, and these games were kind of like made to take advantage of that. And they are both solid, but Daytona is the better one, in my experience. So I didn't play this in the arcade. I know you didn't, because as you said, you hadn't heard of it. But I did. My personal history with Ridge Racer is when I bought a PS2, Ridge Racer Type 4 came with it. I believe the only games I had for PS2 at that point were Ridge Racer Type 4 and Dark Cloud. So those were the two games that I mainly played. So I played like quite a lot of Type 4, and I enjoyed it quite a bit, to be honest. It was always more of what can I say? I'd played races before that were more simulators, like F1 style. Where you kind of like have to tweak tires and stuff like that and worry about the condition of the track and what weather it is and stuff like that. And that isn't really fun to me. But Ridge Racer is more of an arcadey kind of thing. Like I said, it's based on NASCAR, so it's like a stock car kind of thing. And yeah, it's The PS2 version was a fun game, definitely a step up from this version, but this is where it all started for that series back in 93.
Yeah, I mean, just based on what I'm seeing, it looks very, very similar. The main difference being that this seems to have had more of a foothold on PlayStation than Daytona did on Sega. But even then, you know, Sony has Gran Turismo as its, you know, in-house racing brand. So that that kind of overshadowed this, which is probably why I hadn't heard of it. But that's more like you talked about the more simulationist type of thing. Like Gran Turismo fits more into that category than this one does.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, Gran Turismo was also kind of like proper cars, but it was more definitely more simulator kind of thing. I did actually play Gran Turismo on the original PS1. Not a hell of a lot of it, because I like preferred like my arcade races, like I've mentioned.
Right.
But this is, you know, I complained about Daytona USA only having three tracks. This has one.
Oh, geez.
This has like one track, and depending on what difficulty you pick, parts of the track are like cordoned off. So it's like the illusion of different tracks, but as you get more and more up in the difficulty levels, just more of the track is available to be raced on. It's still the same track, which sucks. You know, we're kind of used to racing games now having a load of like anyone who has played Mario Kart 8 recently, with the amount of tracks that they've added to that, there are dozens and dozens and dozens of tracks like Mario Kart 8. I know that's a very different kind of game to this, but to go back to one like this and only have one track is a bit... It just feels a little bit cheap.
Yeah.
I know that obviously you have kind of like limitations on a lot of these games if you're going to have a decent looking racer in the arcade at this point. You can't spend a huge amount of memory on a lot of other stuff. But you'd want more than one track, I would say.
Right.
Like you'd want more than three, like Daytona had, but it makes it so that it's not you don't have a lot of variety. And in the arcade, yeah, you know, you put in your coin, you do a race, fair enough. Same kind of complaint I had with Daytona, but if you are buying this for console, £40-50 with one track, you're going to be even more disappointed than you were with Daytona.
Yeah. We've seen, I mean, obviously it's, you know, like you said, different games, different, you know, time periods, but we've seen, you know, different parts of a track done in better ways. Because, like, I remember there's some of the pod racing games will have, like, the same portions of track for different levels, but you're going on to different parts of it. So, like, even that's one thing that I know from some other racing games is, you know, even the portioning off sections of the track that can be done so much better. Oof. Yikes, that's rough.
I should say as well, from the obviously I only played the home console versions of these. Ridge Racer is definitely an easier game than Daytona. It is a lot easier to get into first place. I mean, Daytona, you've got like 40 races. It's really difficult to get to number one on that. You only have like 12 on this, but it is a lot easier to control. And whereas you can crash in Daytona and it'll put you back, it doesn't put you back much, like you'd land back on the track again. This doesn't have crashes. It just slows you down. So it is, I would say, more beginner friendly. But one thing that a lot of these games have, which I don't really understand why you'd have this, is the timer. Like Daytona had this as well. If you're playing a race, you know, the goal is to kind of like pass all these other races. Why add a timer to it as well? I don't really understand that. I know Outrun had it as well, but why do so many of these games have a timer on them?
The only thing I can think of is because they're designed to steal quarters. Like, that's the only thing I can think of.
Yeah. Like on the Saturn version of Daytona, you can turn the timer off. But I didn't notice an option to turn the timer off on this one. Maybe there is one, and I just missed it. But it just seems kind of like an arbitrary thing. Like if you're going into a racing game, your objective is to get to the front. Why add a timer as well?
Right.
But still, it's a decent game, decent soundtrack. The soundtrack isn't as good as Daytona. In fact, one of the playthroughs of this that I looked at on YouTube, the person playing it had actually modded it to play the Daytona soundtrack instead.
That's funny.
It is just a better soundtrack. It's an important series, like historically, and it did spawn better games later on. Mm-hmm. But it is not as fondly remembered as Daytona, definitely.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's just the nature of the business, really. I mean, you do a thing, someone else comes along and does it better. But it's also like, I feel like the NASCAR, like the NASCAR audience isn't a massive overlap with video game fans. And I mean, I could be inaccurate on that, but you know, I've noticed that there's a lot of the people that play racing video games are more interested in either kart racers or simulationist racers. They're not really into the stock car games.
Yeah.
So it was much more suited to arcades than the modern gaming landscape. But yeah, both of these really, they did well at the time and for what they were. But it's, you know, difficult or impossible to go back to them.
I mean, literally impossible to go back to them because you can't play them on modern consoles.
Yeah.
But that's major corporations and video game preservation point.
Yep. Which, you know, we could do an entire episode on video game preservation and not even scratch the surface.
Mm.
But we won't, because that'll just be depressing.
Yeah, just like a 2-hour rant.
Yeah, basically. So yeah, I think we've pretty much exhausted this. I mean, it's, this one is a little bit easier to find in terms of home console releases. But if you're going to do that, you might as well track down some of the later versions, which are probably better.
Yeah, I can definitely recommend the PS2 version.
Mm-hmm. I've seen there's a few for PS2, original Xbox, 360. So like, you know, these games shouldn't be forgotten about, but they definitely are. They were definitely surpassed by different types of games later.
Yeah, definitely. They are still fun to go back to for like just a blast of arcade fun.
Yeah, and that's, you know, that's honestly the main appeal, is just to remember the arcade days. I think that's about all we have. So we'll take a quick break and then come back and finish up.
Okay.
All right, so that is our, I guess, NASCAR-focused episode. Mostly focused on Daytona, but there's, you know, the NASCAR isn't really as huge of a thing in video games, so that's close enough.
I knew what Daytona was years before I knew what NASCAR was.
I mean, NASCAR's kind of hard to avoid in the U.S., but that's, you know, it's a much, much bigger deal here. But it's also not a huge deal to me. So there's not a ton that I can really say about NASCAR itself.
It's fun to go back and look at like some arcade rivals. And maybe we would have got to Ridge Racer on its own at some point. But I think it works more as kind of like looking at it in terms of a rival to Daytona, and kind of like comparing the two.
Yeah, because I mean, I don't know that I would have really paid much attention to this outside of its connections to Daytona, because Daytona is the one that I'm familiar with. It's the one that I actually played. But yeah, I mean, it's, you know, they're not terrible. They're just not as notable as some of the other racing games out there.
Yeah, and I think that both are really good for what they are, but there are better things.
Yeah, that's basically it. I don't know when. I'm not going to say exactly when we'll be back, because I am effectively booked solid for the next 2 months. But we will return. We will have more video games. But until then, I guess we'll just say goodbye.
Okay, goodbye.